Hi, everybody. I'm Sean from Follow the Camino, and welcome to another episode of Camino Talks. I'm here today with a professor of art history, Dr. Jennifer Alexander from Warwick University in England. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so Dr. Alexander, first of all, thank you for joining us. Perhaps you could give us a little overview of who you are and what your work is, if you don't mind.
Okay, slight correction. I haven't yet made professor. I'm actually reader in art history, but professor sounds good. I work on medieval buildings. In particular, I'm interested in the way that these buildings are constructed. My area of expertise is actually mason's marks, these ciphers that are left on the building by the constructing masons, in fact, when they're cutting the stone in the quarry, to determine how they get paid for the work they're doing. And various other things as well come under that sort of heading.
Okay, great. Thank you. So the reason I contacted you is because I came across an article in the Observer newspaper a few weeks ago talking about kind of a selfie hidden in the eaves of the cathedral in Santiago de Compostela. Perhaps you could talk through why that article was produced or what was interesting about that.
Yeah, this was something that we spotted when we were working in the building a few years ago. And a journalist contacted me for a story, and I thought this would make a nice piece to talk about. What happened was that we were studying the building stone by stone. So we were upstairs in the building in the galleries, and we were looking at every piece of stonework up there to see if it was marked. And in particular, we were looking at the carved capitals, and we thought, goodness me, at this height where nobody can see them, they're all the same, and they're all rather dull. And then suddenly, there's a little figure in one of them, and he's hanging onto the capital. He's got a little smile on his face, and suddenly it occurred to us, this is one of the stonemasons. He's put himself on the capital just as a mark of devilment, I think, you know. I've done 15 of these all the same. I'm going to do one slightly different. And if the boss doesn't mind, then I'm going to immortalize myself in stone. And this is something that stonemasons do. I was talking to one who's working on a restoration project at the moment, and he said, I had a word with the boss and I was allowed to put my pet on the carving when we finished it. It's high up, nobody will see it. I said, well, what's your pet? And he said, it's a ferret. So in future, somebody's going to ask the question, why is there a ferret on Lincoln Cathedral? And the answer is, it was a stonemason's pet. So these are the sort of touches which really bring the buildings to life for us, I think.
Okay, and we'll talk about, I suppose, the life and how cathedrals get constructed in a moment, but perhaps in relation to the cathedral in Santiago de Compostela, could you maybe fill us in a little bit on its history or its importance, particularly from the medieval ages, which is your speciality?
Yeah, it's a vitally important building because it's, oh gosh, where does one start? Okay, ever since the relics of St. James were found in northern Spain, there's been some sort of building on the site, a place where people can come to meet with the saint. And that's still the case. In the crypt under the east end of Compostela Cathedral, there are still the relics of St. James, and that's what the faithful come to visit. And so there has to be a place where you come to venerate the saint, make contact with him, and perhaps hope that your prayers will be answered. And gradually over the years, the building has become more and more elaborate. So each time there's a new, perhaps there's a new person in charge in Compostela, or there's a lot of money comes in, they can afford to build a new building. And in the late 11th century, they started building the great cathedral we can see today. They had to build it around an existing one, and that gave them a few problems in putting the whole thing up, but these were overcome. And from the late 11th century onwards, we get the fabulous building we've got now. And they virtually built it end to end during the 12th century, finishing with the great Portico de la Gloria, where the pilgrims enter the cathedral, this marvellous sculptured portico with the figure of Christ on it and the wonderful musicians round the arch. And then in the 18th century, they added a new facade in front of it, which is the outside view we have of the cathedral now, a great Baroque splendour. And also at that time, they added a lot of ornamental work around the high altar to make it really very special.
Yes.
It's very elaborate, it's very colourful, and it fills that eastern space around the high altar. So the whole place celebrates the saint. It's also a very practical building. It doesn't have the problems. It would never have the problems that Notre Dame had in Paris. It can't burn down because it's got a stone roof with a stone stone vault under a stone roof. So it's completely fireproof. It's also got a fabulous acoustic, and it's brilliantly designed so that large numbers of pilgrims can move through the space at any time without disturbing any service that's going on.
Yes.
Okay. So it is the ultimate brilliant design for a medieval church. It's fulfilling lots of functions, and it can do them as well now in the 21st century as it could back in the 12th.
And in your knowledge, how does it compare as a building to other kind of cathedrals around the world? Like, is it?
Okay. It's one of the most significant, and it's got this extraordinary feature in that it was replicated almost exactly in a series of other buildings on the pilgrim routes. So if you're coming down from France and you come through Conques, which is a little town in the hills in southern France, and there's the little church of Saint-Foy at Conques, and it's a miniature version of Compostela. It replicates it on a smaller scale. So for pilgrims who can't do the whole pilgrimage all the way down through France, across the Pyrenees and across the northern Spain, if they stop at Conques, they've made a significant part of their pilgrimage, and they've reached a place which reminds them of Compostela. And there were five of these churches dotted across the pilgrim routes so that people could have the sense of having achieved an important part of their pilgrimage, even if their resources didn't allow them to take the whole pilgrimage. And they could start again there next time when they had the chance. So this is really unusual in medieval buildings. They very rarely copy each other exactly, but the Compostela archetype is the one that's chosen for these significant buildings on the pilgrim route.
Very interesting. So can you maybe talk a little bit about how a cathedral gets constructed? Because I understand the cathedral in Santiago de Compostela, it took maybe 100, 150 years to build. How does that process work? Who pays for that work? And as people die, how do they keep to the plan, or do plans change all the time? How does it get funded? What is the process?
Okay, those are really big questions. money drives a lot of this. If there's good funding, then a building can go up quite quickly. And we've got a very useful document, the Codex Calixtinus, which may be familiar to your viewers, which actually tells us that there were 50 masons who were working on this building when it first started. And we had one of those amazing moments when we were processing our results from gathering the masons' marks, and we realized we got 50 different marks. It was almost as if they were there. We'd picked up on this team. So if the funding is good, then you can build quite quickly. And this is usually the responsibility of a dean rather than a bishop. But if you've got a bishop who's enthusiastic, he can really push things along. And that's what we think was happening at Compostela. The accounts always describe it as the work of the bishop, because the bishop is the senior man and it's appropriate to do so. And we think that that's probably the case at Compostela, where the bishop is driving the works. So he's the one who goes and talks to people like the king and persuades the king that this is a project that he should fund, or there may well be wealthy merchants who want to contribute, but it's the funding that drives it. But there's a little known fact about Compostela, and that is that they were going to do a huge building project in the 14th century, and they started it, but they never got very far with it. And if you get the chance to get inside the closed-in area around the east end of the cathedral, you can actually see the footings of this abandoned project. So there, I think the money ran out. But that would have made the building even bigger. And that would have completely changed the area around where the high altar was and where St. James is. But clearly there, the money didn't last.
Yes.
But just the sheer organisation of this, finding the quarries, finding the workforce, bringing them all together, training up people to be stonemasons, to do the work, getting a designer, getting a master mason with the vision that fits with what you need.
Yes.
All of these are huge questions. And we don't, unfortunately, have a lot of the answers yet, because the documentary sources that would tell us these things don't exist.
Okay.
So that's the problem. The main document we've got is the monument itself, And so this is why we study the monument very closely, to see what it will tell us about itself. And often we get some very interesting answers that way.
Okay. So you've mentioned several occasions the Mason's Marks. So I've read in another article that can be described maybe as the medieval version of the IKEA flat pack instructions. So what are they, and why are they important, and why are you involved in cataloguing them and researching them?
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's how to put something together without written instructions. Because the moment you have written instructions, somebody will read them wrongly. I think we've all got an IKEA bookcase somewhere with one of the shelves in backwards.
Yes.
It's so easy to get it wrong if you're working from written instructions. Okay, let's project that back into the Middle Ages, where literacy was not common. So you have to find ways of conveying information from one group of people to another, which works outside literacy. And what we discovered at Compostela was a really neat system. In order to build some of the arches upstairs in the gallery round the high altar, they put a coding system, a little mark that went on the flat block that sits on top of the capital. And that mark told the masons which stones made up the arch that was standing on it. And it's obvious that this was a system that was worked out on the ground. They checked the fit of all the blocks to make sure they made a good arch, and then they put these coded marks on them so that, for instance, a 5-point star, all the stones with that mark on it would go in the same arch, and they'd know which arch it was because there on the block above the capital is a little 5-point star. And so that was what they did. And it's very interesting that it's a system that's only used by one of the master masons, because at the point where there's a change of design in the building, they stop using that system. But it's a brilliant way of making sure that everything fits perfectly.
Okay. And are those marks applied at the quarrying stage, or when they're transported to the site, or do they differ throughout the process?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's got to happen in the workshop, where they're shaping the wedge-shaped blocks that make up the arches. They're a bit like pineapple chunks when you open a tin of pineapple. They're wedge-shaped and they fit precisely to put the arch together. So we think that it's where they dry assemble the arch. So that's happening in the workshop. One of the things we found, which is a little bit complicated, is to do with the scaffoldings. When you're building, you put up a scaffolding and you work off it to assemble something. Well, we worked out that if the on the two sides of the building, they have to have a separate scaffolding. So that was a slightly different system. When they have, when they're building the ring of arches round the east end upstairs, they've got one scaffolding, and there's a little bit of interchange up there. Obviously, once they had the mortar on the blocks, the fit wasn't quite so good. So you can see them swapping between the arches. The first two on each arch have got the right symbol on. And then on one or two of them, they're starting to swap them around, because they pick up the stone and they put it up and it's not right.
Yeah.
So, too much mortar or not enough mortar. So they reach for the chap working next to them and say, have you got one that's a little bit bigger than this? And the chap says, yeah, have this one. So they put that one in. So it goes a little bit out of kilter. Okay. But it's because they're working together on the scaffolding and they can do that. Whereas on the two sides of the building where they've got different scaffoldings, they can't do that so easily. Yeah. It would mean going up and down the ladders and, you know, it would be difficult. So we're getting a lot of insights on the way that these people are working. And it's all very practical. That's the point.
Yes. So you spoke about doing a study in the cathedral. So my understanding is that was kind of funded by the Galician regional government. So What was the purpose of that study, and what is the outcome, or is the work still to be done?
Yeah, the purpose of it was to try and explain to people how the building work of the late 11th century got started, what they managed to achieve in that first building phase. So we were working, as you say, funded by the Galician regional government. They were very kind to us. And we work as part of a team with people from the University of Santiago de Compostela, who had expertise on sculpture and on economic geography and aspects of that. And we published a book at the end of it.
Okay.
In Spanish, which sold out almost immediately. So it hit the spot.
Very good.
This wasn't intended to be some sort of dry academic tome, but was written in a way that made it accessible to people. And we had some very good responses to it.
And I also know that the cathedral has been undergoing renovation in the last number of years. So did your work feed into that, or do you know if that renovation is continuing? Or?
Right, yes, there's been an ongoing program. Obviously, with a building of that age, there's always work to be done. And they've been doing a lot of conservation work high up on the paintings on the vault, which are an important series of 18th century paintings. And yes, they've the building's still full of scaffolding for that. So they're working in the crossing area at the moment. And yes, they are aware that these masons' marks need to be recorded. And we would very much like to go back and do more work there as soon as conditions allow us to.
Yes, indeed. So when I was researching your work and the articles, it put me in mind of a book that I read a number of years ago. I think it's quite famous. It's called Pillars of the Earth by an English author, Ken Follett. Mm. And for me, it was a trilogy set around the building of a cathedral and a town in medieval England, spread over hundreds of years. And it went from almost like a village where nothing, and then the whole process and the history and the wars and the fighting and the intrigue in building a cathedral and a cathedral town. So does the content of that book or books ring true to you?
Yeah, Ken Follett sought advice on writing that for the architectural aspects of it. And he was advised by a leading architectural historian to make sure he got the detail right. And he's very subtle in his writings. His characters really come to life and you really get a sense of what it must have been like to be there at the time. And equally, he doesn't make them do anything that they wouldn't have done at the time. So he modelled his building on the great early Gothic Saint-Denis in the northern suburbs of Paris, where Gothic architecture starts. So his protagonist is the man that is involved in bringing this new style of architecture to life. And he very carefully doesn't have the abbot of Saint-Denis as the man who comes up with the ideas. And that is exactly right, because in the 19th century, everybody assumed that because the abbot of Saint-Denis writes an amazing account of his own exploits and puts himself dead center in it, people got the view that it was this Abbot Suger, who came up with Gothic architecture. And Ken Follett was very anxious to avoid that. Yes. So I admire his writings, I must say.
And it depicted the kind of different hierarchies in the stone masons and kind of the apprentices and the juniors and the masters and so on. So can you maybe talk a little, just briefly, about that kind of hierarchy? Who was a stonemason? Why was it a good job?
Right, it's a slightly strange job, because during the Middle Ages, most people, when they reached sort of 12 or 14, would be looking for an apprenticeship. And most of the apprenticeships were in guilds, so it would be within their hometown, and they'd go away, well, they wouldn't go away, they'd sign up to be a silversmith or a saddler or a potter or something like that, and they would be trained and they would make their works and they'd stay in their hometown. But stonemasonry stood outside that system, because most towns couldn't support an industry for stone building. They might have a church that was stone, but very few other buildings. So what we have instead is a system based on the quarries and on the big building sites, like Compostela itself, where you would have a long tradition of training people, and people would be sent away from home for this. So you'd get somebody, a likely person, usually a boy, who would go away and train as a stonemason for 7 years. And during that time, he'd learn how to make squared blocks precisely. And that's an incredibly skilled job, to get the cube block exactly square. He'd also learn how to do basic carving, how to do mouldings around doorways, how to carve straightforward capitals, and the very skilled job of carving these things from a template. Now, the master mason is the man that designs those templates. He's the individual, and I'm afraid we don't have any references to female masters yet, but they may be out there. And these are the people who can envisage something in three dimensions and then break it down to two dimensions, so that you design a template which will then be put on the flat block of a piece of stone, and from that the mason carves down and he creates the elaborate shapes of a molding for a doorway or a window. So the master mason has those gifts, and you've got to be a master having completed your apprenticeship The master would look around at the newly qualified masons and he would see, oh, you know, so-and-so over there's got particular drawing skills or is a particularly bright person. And they would then do a second apprenticeship and work with the master. And they would be taught things like, wow, here's, let me show you one of the secrets of the master masons. I was doing this with students yesterday. This is a piece of string with 13 knots in.
Okay.
And these have turned up in Egyptian pyramids and on medieval building sites. And these are ways of laying out things like a right angle on the ground. With 13 knots, if you lay out a triangle with sides of 3, 4, and 5 knots, you get a right angle. It's Pythagoras, okay. But you don't need to know it's Pythagoras. It's simply practical geometry. These are the secrets of the medieval masons, how to do things like that, and how to know how high you can build relative to the width of the building for the building to be safe and also to look fabulous.
Yes.
So this is where the second apprenticeship comes in. And we know about these from the pay rates. You suddenly get a master with an apprentice, and the apprentice is paid at the same rate as the regular masons, but he's still called an apprentice. So he's the master's apprentice, and he's the one that's being shown practical geometry and also how to run the site, how to keep the supply of stone running, because they don't store stone.
Yeah.
They cut it and use it almost immediately because they don't have to pay for storage. So there's things like that, and they organize the whole process, and they also have engineering skills. So that's the system. And it meant that highly skilled individuals could come from very humble backgrounds and rise to be really significant people.
So in Santiago de Compostela, do you think the stonemasons were local, or did they travel from other countries or regions to Santiago? Or how were they recruited?
Yeah, excuse me. Yeah, that's a hard question to answer. One of the things I'm thinking about quite hard is, yeah, did they get brought in? Was the promise of a good secure job for a few years enough to make people leave home in Cleon or Burgos or even perhaps France and make the journey to this remote part of Spain in order to work on a project? There had to be the promise that there would be a good job for a number of years. The examples in England we have where they're going to put up a new building, if it's a monastic house, the mother house will sometimes send over its master and a few key people to work on the site, and then they establish the site and stay there, and then they bring in local people to train, so that by the second generation it's local people. They do it that way, and I'm wondering if something like that was working in Spain as well. Where did they get their master from? You know, when the clergy sat down and said, right, we can go ahead, let's start the building project. Where did they go for their master?
Yes.
Yeah, this is the big question. And a lot of people want it to be possibly from Southwest France. And other people are saying, no, it couldn't possibly be. So there's a lot of debate around this. And the arguments go backwards and forwards.
Okay. And the material for the cathedral in Santiago, so do you think that would have been quarried locally or again specialized in?
Yeah, it's granite. It's a particularly intractable material, and they've done amazing things with carving it. And I'm not completely sure that we know where the quarries were. Usually they try and move stone as short a distance as possible. They do have the advantage that the coast isn't that far away. And where possible, they ship stone down the rivers and across the sea. So it's possible that they were moving it that way. But there's a lot of questions still to be answered, such as how long was the building season? I mean, the climate in Compostela is pretty much like Atlantic climate anywhere. They get a lot of rain. And so in England, for instance, there's no building work done in the winter because of the risk of frost.
Yeah.
The idea being that because you're building a construction that's got an outer skin of two skins of stone with rubble in the middle. And so when it comes to the winter, you don't want the frost getting in and cracking the stone through the expansion of the freezing water. So they thatched the walls and sent everybody home.
Yes.
We don't know if they're doing that in Compostela. I mean, it's not that cold because we've noticed that birds continue to nest or live in the cloister at Compostela right through the winter. So it's not that cold. Whereas in England, the equivalent birds would have left for South Africa.
Yeah.
So it's now not that cold. What was it like in the 12th century? Were they able to carry on working through the winter? You know, there's so many questions one needs to ask and so many different people we need to talk to. Climatologists, what was Compostela's weather like in 1120?
Yes. Okay. Interesting. Again, doing research on you, I noticed you did an interview last year in relation to the burning of the spire in Notre Dame. Mm. And you were asked the question, should it be replicated in the way it was, or should there be a modern design put on it? And I know this is a big debate in France. And you gave quite an interesting answer there. You kind of were leaning towards, let's do a modern version of it.
Mm. Yeah. It's because that's what they did in the medieval past. They respected their predecessors' work, but they always added something of their own. And so they wouldn't have said, well, we've got something that we've lost. Let's just pretend it never happened. They've always said, let's make something better out of this. Let's take this opportunity to do something spectacular from our own age, to make our own contribution to the history of this building. And that spire at Notre Dame in Paris was built by Viollet-le-Duc, the great 19th century restorer. I mean, it was a beautiful object in its own right. He claimed that he found the footings for it actually within the roof in Paris. And I'm sure he did. But what he came up with was his version of a Gothic flesh.
Yes.
So have we got to replicate a 19th century version of a medieval flesh? Or do we take the opportunity to come up with something really interesting and bold? And this is where we have the problem now, that we seem to have this sort of lack of confidence in our own skills in design that wasn't there in the Middle Ages. They were convinced they could do better. So it would be nice if there was an architect of great vision around now who could come up with something spectacular and not just a terrible pastiche, but equally spectacular in a very positive way that people could relate to. So it's probably an impossible brief.
Okay. So does that mean then that the kind of the skills and the kind of the masons of the medieval age, has that kind of job kind of almost died out? Is it because we don't have enough of them anymore?
Not true, no. The skill set is still there. It's coming from a different area now. A lot of stonemasons these days are people that have been through art college, and they are sculptors and workers in stone. But having said that, a lot of the medieval techniques are still alive. And there's an amazing site in France near the town of Auxerre. There is a castle. They're building a castle out of a quarry, a place called Guédelon, where they have this this remarkable project, and stonemasons and carpenters and tilers and rope makers and all sorts of ancillary trades around all of that have come together, and it's a training shop. And people there are learning how to build like medieval masons, and they're constructing this wonderful castle out of their quarry, and they're using existing skills and discovering how effective they are. And what's extraordinary is that we're moving back to some of those skills. In quarrying, for instance, the traditional way of quarrying is you drill a hole, you take an iron wedge, you drive a series of these iron wedges in the holes you've done in a line, hit them with a mallet, and the stone breaks off the surface. Well, in the more recent past, they've been using explosives for this. But now architects, conservation architects are saying, this is proving to be a problem because you're setting up problems within those stone blocks that you're breaking off with the explosives. It's weakening the stone.
Yeah.
And you don't always see it immediately, but after a few years, suddenly that stone fails. So let's actually go back to the plug and feathers, this idea of using the wedges and the mallets. So the medieval technology is still very much around, and people are still using it because it works.
Interesting.
So, I mean, yeah, we could do with more people training to be stonemasons. because there is a slight shortage of them. A lot of students want to go on to be painting restorers, which is fine. We need them. But some of the big projects could do is a few more stonemasons.
Very good. So one last question, and I really appreciate your time. In terms of the cathedral in Santiago, was anything that really surprised you that you didn't know about it, that you discovered?
Well, apart from finding this little stonemason, that was a delight, it was the fact that we discovered this assembly system, because we'd speculated that something like this would exist. You know, this business of marking up the blocks on top of the capitals with the coding for the arch stones. We'd speculated that that probably existed for a number of sites, but we assumed that it was on the invisible faces of the stone blocks, because you only need to see it when you're holding the stone block in your hand and then goes in the building and nobody sees it. We were expecting we might find it, but this is the first time we've actually found it on the building. So that was a nice moment when we were looking at it and saying, hang on a minute, what's going on here? Ah, we know what they're doing. Yes, that was nice, because you find these assembly marks on everything that's being constructed up until the recent past. You know, if you look at great big steam engines, if you close up on the bearings on a steam engine, they're quite often stamped, because the bearings made up of lots of different elements, and they've all stamped with the same number so that it goes together in the right order. And they're on gun mechanisms. I've seen them on stained glass. They're on timber buildings, a lot of them on timber frame buildings, to get so that the joints fit together perfectly. But to find it on a stone building like that was a first.
Okay, great. Well, listen, Dr. Alexander, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. It's a very interesting topic, and obviously it's very close to a lot of people's hearts in terms of the Camino and the cathedral, which is one of the key parts of the Camino. So thank you very much for your time.
You're most welcome. It's been fun talking to you.
Great. Thank you. Bye-bye.